Succession number 21564, reel 25.
Colonel Cormack, reel 25. You were saying that Robin Carnegie took a particular interest in Soviet tactics. Was that interest put to any practical use?
Yes, we did. Quite a lot of theoretical, based on my previous experience in Brixmas, which I think talking to him about that sparked it off. And he was particularly keen that we should be able to recognize from sightings of Soviet forces advancing towards us what that implied. In other words, if we saw a certain bit of kit, that was clearly like a PT-76, which was their amphibious tank, was a reconnaissance equipment. And he was very keen that we should be able to recognize straight away that that was a reconnaissance unit of perhaps a motor rifle regiment or even a higher formation. And then the other types of equipment, like the BTR-60Ps, the armored personnel carriers, whether they were wheeled or amphibious APCs, what sort of tanks were coming through, were they the T-62s, which was the main tank at that time, later superseded by the M-72. And to be able to make a judgment of what actually was heading towards us, a realistic judgment, and that we wouldn't panic at the first sight of Soviet equipment, we could take a measured approach and say, that's the reconnaissance, that's the motor rifle regiment, and that's probably part of such and such a motor rifle division, or a tank regiment, or a tank division, to be able to identify those and react accordingly. And that we did a lot of lectures on that, and sort of, you know, like, if you like, cloth model type exercises, chutes, and wrote some brigade operational procedures for that, describing what the Soviets would do under the heading, of course, of the Orange Forces, which was the traditional name for the enemy at that time. And I thoroughly enjoyed that, putting into practice things I'd done before. And then when we came after, say, our tour of Ireland, I mentioned Exercise Eternal Triangle took on a slightly different idea, and we practiced this. We were in defense, and to make it realistic, again, I employed battle simulation on a scale that I had previously used when I was at Warminster on Salisbury Plain, to give them some idea, almost round for round, what they could expect the Soviet artillery to give covering fire to their forces and what that would sound like. And we knew pretty well how many guns that they were likely to have per motor rifle division or tank division, almost to the round. And you could then expect, in our defensive positions, several hundred rounds coming down in that sort of area. We matched that with our battle simulation to give us nearer a representation of what it was going to be like as possible. And I think that was both useful and also enjoyable for those taking part, because they really felt, now, this is coming to grips with it in a different sort of way. And it was entirely due to the drive of Robin Carnegie to get this going, and a couple of extremely good brigade majors that we had. One, David Sands, I must mention him, was a tank regiment. I really thought he would go to Army board level, but he chose a different path and left the Army. But his successor was a bright young major called Peter Inge, of whom you may have heard, who I'm actually having dinner with next Thursday, as it happens, took on, and he followed this idea up and proved to be a tremendous tower of strength, and it was no surprise that he rose to be Chief of the Defence Staff in years to come, but that was a little byway.
What did the soldiers think of the requirement to act as if they were Soviets? Did they take to it as a role?
Yes, they took to it very well, and I think they enjoyed that, because they felt they were doing, in a slightly different way, a constructive approach to the problem we had in those days of the Cold War, of a fairly large and thought to be very effective and efficient and massive Soviet army waiting the group of Soviet forces in Germany waiting to come to the West and smash us. And that was the thought at that time. This was, let's say, the 1971-72 period. That was the main thought. And anything that helped us to understand what the problem was and how we were dealing with it and how realistically we were dealing with it was good for both, for all of us, whichever part we were playing.
You had a good working knowledge of Soviet habits and customs and appearances from your experience at Bricksmith. Were you able to draw on any other sources of information about more recent developments in the Soviet forces while you were at 1st Division?
Well, only in as much as I was able to read the intelligence reports that were put out on the Soviet army. There were periodically reports sent out in the form of a magazine, if you like. The more sensitive equipment, of course, we weren't told about because that was kept under wraps for those who needed to know. But they did publish regularly a sort of A4 paperback with notes on Soviet equipment and changes that were useful to us. And I was able to add that to my own personal knowledge and see how things had changed. Whether they had changed as we expected or not was always a great interest. So one was able to keep up to date pretty well with that, as far as we needed to in that field.
What about changes in Soviet tactics or techniques? Were there any significant changes that you can recollect hearing about from that period?
Not at that time. There was perhaps slightly more emphasis in the 70s than before on the Soviet use of special troops, Spetsnaz, parachute-type commandos, special forces who would be dropped, flown or dropped or parachute or infiltrate far ahead to disrupt our command centers and command and control centers and perhaps important traffic positions or junctions. There, we had to take great care of that and try and work out how we would react to that sort of attack, which never, in fact, materialized.
These would essentially be distraction operations in the rear area.
And to cause confusion and disruption,
yes.
Which would precede their great thrusts of their motor rifle and armored divisions and formations coming down through westwards towards us.
How was 1st Division planning to deal with that sort of threat?
It wasn't much of a problem, direct problem for us. The results would have been a problem, but that was for core troops and those further behind, particularly Rheindahl, an obvious place.
Yes.
Core headquarters, 1st British Corps headquarters, would have to be aware of that. They would have taken measures for that, for their protection in their particular area around behind us. So the effects of their operations would have worried us, but we were not too concerned because they were going to operate behind us, as it were.
They'd have been further back, deeper,
yes,
in your rear.
Yeah.
Normally, dealing with that sort of threat often comes down to locally generated territorial defence troops.
Yes, the territorial army would have played a part there, plus the normal troops in the formations behind us at Ryanair Air and other static, if you like, organisations had to be ready and have their own emergency procedures to deal with those operations should they arise. And that gave them, of course, a much more active role than they might otherwise have thought necessary. And it was a stimulation to them, not knowing what might happen, but they had to be ready and had to be as combat ready as their friends in the forward formations.
There are no longer any rear areas, are there, in the face of such a threat?
There was no safe hiding place, if you like. You were likely to be hit by the enemy at any time in any place.
Thinking about it, bearing in mind what you saw of the North Koreans and the Chinese, what you knew about the Russians, were the North Koreans and Chinese similar in their approach to basic operational techniques and minor tactics? Or did they differ?
Their general approach was somewhat similar, but of course at the time of my experience in Korea, the Chinese and North Koreans, certainly the North Koreans, lost all their armor during the very first assault south, and the eventual battering they got destroyed pretty well all their armour. When the Chinese intervened later on and helped revive the North Korean forces to a certain extent, they just did not have the armoured equipment in either, there's no army personnel carriers, for example. That was something quite different. They had massive artillery, of which they made excellent use, but they had little armour and no armoured personnel carriers. The Chinese and Koreans covered the ground on foot, largely, and that was a major difference. So the rate of progress of the Soviets in Western Europe was potentially much faster because they were, say, much more mobile, and they had masses of the equipment to move them forward until they chose to disembark and then assault on foot.
Did you ever encounter the idea of tactical norms?
Not really. All we had seen of them in the actions that the Soviet Army had fought at the end of World War II, there were a few film clips of the Soviet Army in action against China on the frontier along the Azuri, I think it was the Azuri River. And we had access to film of the Soviet Army in action then, and that would be, what, 45, 46, 47 period.
Well,
it was quite interesting to see that how they moved up in APCs and then disembarked and then ran forward with their heavy greatcoats, which they wore in those days, reminiscent of almost the wartime and pre-war army. Those greatcoats and things were quite conspicuous in the films and very cumbersome to run in, presumably thought to be quite warm in the winter conditions, which they were used to in that part of the world. That had changed, and their uniforms were certainly much more combat friendly, if you like, than those previous that we had seen in those films. But we hadn't noticed any dramatic change in their general tactics. They were dealing with, of course, a massive conscript army, and conscripts from a great variety of places. The Soviet Army conscript who came from, say, the Moscow region or the northern region around Leningrad, as it was then, or indeed the south and the Crimea, they were used to certain conditions, but a huge number of their conscripts came from, you might say, the Muslim areas in the south, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, whose knowledge of the Russian language was perhaps rudimentary. And then you added to those of more oriental experience from the Far East, from Eastern Siberia. They were, again, almost a different nationality. And again, their knowledge of Russian, which was supposed to be their number one language, was, again, fairly rudimentary. So the idea of training those and giving them orders because of the language problem and also their different backgrounds meant that they had to keep things very, very simple. And I think that was a major factor in the deciding what tactics they would use. Keep it very simple. They were not largely equipped with maps. They were often very unsure exactly where they were. And living in East Germany, as we had seen before, they were generally confined to the barracks area. Their recreation was all inside barracks. They were only very, very senior warrant officers and officers, regular officers, were actually allowed out of barracks to any extent. And only they had clubs, and very few of those, outside barracks. They were brought in by train, sent to a barracks, and then they trained there, and that was their life. Quite different approach from ours, but it essentially meant that to wheel those into a fighting force, you had to keep things very simple and basic.
So essentially, would you say they were learning drills?
Learning drills, exactly. And it had to be, and they were very good at it. They were much more specialized than we were. Particularly, I noticed that in the engineers, our sappers were they all cry, soldiers first, sappers second, but they were trained to operate in minefields, mine clearing, mine laying, demolitions, booby traps, bridging, you name it, all the different things. The Russians had bridging companies, and that was all they did. They practiced on one piece of equipment and became exceptionally good at it. If they were a mine laying, that was all they did. They were not flexible. They couldn't switch a mine laying company to do a bridging operation as we could. So their whole structure was slightly more rigid than ours. We were essentially more flexible and possibly therefore more used to improvising and reacting than they would have been. If things go well for the Soviets, we thought they would be very successful. But if they were held up or disrupted and their plans modified, that there was a potential weakness there.
Does that mean that our planning was based upon the notion of doing the unexpected in order to disorientate their expectations?
That went a lot into it. But we had to have standard drills ourselves.
Yes.
That goes without saying, because then you had to start off like that.
Well, you have standard drills, but if you're thinking at the operational level or strategic level, then presumably if the Russians were planning to conduct a particular style of operations in support of a particular strategy based upon expectations, if you could act in a way that did not conform to expectations, you could disrupt their efforts.
That was certainly part of our thinking, but it was quite difficult to bring in on the first stage. The first stage, you essentially had to go to your GDP plan.
Yes.
And that meant going and laying minefields in certain areas, creating obstacles in certain areas, ensuring communication forward. It was after that stage that we could then improvise or then change things a bit. And we were much more able to react in that way to their operations than they would have been to us. I think that would be the way I would put the emphasis.
But I mean, in the first stages, the objective for an army acting effectively as a covering force would be to gain time by imposing delay on the enemy, by putting obstacles in place. And that sort of procedure is normally dictated to some extent by the terrain, so there's not a lot you can do in the way of surprises.
That's right. You had to appreciate what they were doing. And I think I mentioned that exercise that we had done of planning or working out the obstacles throughout our brigade area and putting those against the items of equipment the Soviets had. Mm-hmm. We knew exactly how many pieces of equipment of each sort and how they would have to use those to cross that without our interference and how it would be used up. The idea of creating our obstacles was so that they would have to use up their gap-crossing bridging equipment before they got to the end of our brigade area. And it was difficult to achieve surprise that way. You just had to work out and create the obstacles. And if you were good at them, then, of course, you would have the surprise element. And after they had run out, for example, if they did, of their gap-crossing equipment, then, of course, they were much more exposed to our reactions, and they were, at that time, I think, less flexibly able to react and do something if they hadn't got the equipment they were used to having, if you see what I mean.
You were saying earlier on that when you first arrived, you went and attended a traditional bridging camp, and that was the last traditional bridging camp that was held because things were changing. What was changing? What was a traditional bridging camp like? What was done there, and how did things change?
Well, again, I was perhaps unlucky or whatever not to have had done a tour in BR before, but when I arrived there, the regiment was just about to set off to bridging camp at Hamelin, and at that time, for a variety of reasons, the CO decided to march all the way from Nienburg down, and that was something different. But when we got to the camp, the whole thing was a three-week, 3 to 4 week program, almost worked out in advance. And I had gone down and seen the staff who ran the camp commandant and his staff, worked out what our program would be, what equipment was there. And essentially what we were doing was going and practicing gap crossing with the heavy girder bridge and the heavy ferry. And you had to make sure that everyone knew how to load the equipment. And it was all mounted on RASC, RCT vehicles at that time. The RCT had just formed. And they were responsible for driving and moving the equipment around. So you had to get used to working with them. Then we were responsible for the tactical loading of all the bridging, make sure it was in the right order, that when your bridging column of RCT arrived at the bridge, the crossing site, that the equipment could be used in the correct way because all the bits that were needed were in the right place. Those were things that had to be practiced before you actually did any bridging. Then we went down to the bridging sites, which were all prepared with concrete hard standings and ramps into the water to make it easy. The cranes were all there, and because they were in the bridging camp, they were all working order. And then you went through the drills of building your bridges under daylight and at night under different conditions, and made sure you could operate those slickly. The heavy ferry was also down there. That was the sort of rafting thing. Had been built for the Conqueror tank, the 80-ton monster that we'd had for a very short time. But it was a very useful ferry because of its capacity. And we had to, again, all had to operate that, put it together, and make sure you could, that the NCOs in charge were able to give their orders from turning on the engines, maneuvering the raft, controlling it, revving up, revving down against the current, and maneuvering the raft so that the ramps could land on the bank. All the basic things to make certain that you were thoroughly familiar with the equipment. And this was timed before the major exercise season, which you then had to operate under slightly different conditions. That was the purpose of bridging camp. At that time, we were beginning to work with the new medium girder bridge. And we were quite fortunate is that one of our squadron commanders had come to the regiment after having done the BOR trials for the medium girder bridge. And in fact, he had got himself an MBE for the work he'd done introducing the medium girder bridge. So we were well placed to make use of that experience. And so there was signs pointing to the way ahead. This was thought to be very good equipment, and we were getting used to it. And we were also practicing ideas on aids to amphibious crossing. These were things that were beginning to grow in importance. And that took 3 weeks. And then, of course, we had our own exercises in the area of Hamelin, all well-trodden paths, if you like. But that was the purpose of the bridging camp. It got the regiment all together again, and you got used to working with each other, and then you could get a chance to spot the promising young NCOs, you know, the troop officers, and indeed the squadron commanders who were showing up well or not showing up well, and gave you a chance to evaluate them. And then you would see how that worked out on the main exercise, which for us was the Eternal Triangle.
How did the medium girder bridge differ from the heavy girder bridge? What in operational terms, in terms of capacity?
It was very much lighter. It was every bit could be carried by hand.
So it was man portable.
It was man portable. Once you'd got to the site on the. And it needed fewer vehicles, and here was another change. The vehicles were all engineer vehicles and not RCT. And that, with the introduction of the floating bridges, the Gilwa I mentioned at first and its replacement by the German M2, meant that the RASC RCT bridging columns gradually faded out. They weren't required, and they eventually were disbanded. So all our equipment then could be either driven along the roads, like the M2 until it came to a river, or with the medium girder bridge, it could be transported virtually in Land Rover and trailer, almost. very light vehicles, which we drove ourselves.
How did they manage to accomplish that change? Was it improvements in metallurgy, or was it improvements in construction technique?
It was improvements in metallurgy that was the key thing. That the main, if you like, in the heavy girder bridge, there were massive steel girders, which were had to be lifted by crane. This was a totally different metal concept, lighter, and every single pond unit of the bridging would float. It was so light, and it was easy to handle and lock together.
Was it made of aluminium or something?
It was an aluminium alloy, if you like.
Alloy replacing steel.
Yes. It was that sort of idea coming in. It was very strong and very light.
Was it up to the same sort of load-bearing as the heavy girder bridge it replaced?
It wasn't designed to replace the heavy girder bridge, which would go up to class 100. That's 100 tons, roughly. Yes. But it would take 50 or 60 tons quite happily.
That would be enough for a main battle tank, wouldn't it?
Which was the Centurion and its replacement, the Chieftain coming in. It would take that quite easily. Yeah. And that was the great difference. We didn't have to worry about 100-ton loads previously. The heavy girder bridge retained a role in the LOC, the line of communications, further back. And it was still used for that. And indeed, TA regiments, the territorial regiments coming in, would be familiar with the heavy girder bridge. And right behind us in the Cora area, and behind that even, the heavy girder bridge had a part to play, and the territorialists would do it.
So it ceased to be a divisional asset and became a core asset.
Yes, that's the thing, yes. Yeah. And it was the Meeting Girder Bridge, in its basic form, was also transportable, constructed by helicopter. So theoretically and in practice, you could actually build the bridge some way behind undercover and then get a Chinook lifted up and drop it onto the river crossing. Provided, of course, and the bank was the right length and so on, but that was obviously a prerequisite. But it had that flexibility. That was the basic medium girder bridge. Like everything else, it got more sophisticated as time went on, and in the years afterwards, you could make it longer, you could build piers for it. All hand-constructed, but it developed in a... But that was the basic medium girder bridge that was coming in at that time. It's like the analogy between the original Bailey Bridge and the heavy girder bridge. Things always get more complicated, thought to be even more improvements, and usually got slightly more difficult to build. But it was a very good bridge, a very good concept.
And you were saying that this sort of bridging camp never happened again, or didn't while you were there. Why was that? What happened to the...
Well, because we no longer had the RASC bridging columns, we didn't work on the heavy girder bridge, that was all taken back. The heavy ferry was used, but that was only an option for... It wasn't the main thing. The main thing was using the M2 bridge and the medium girder bridge, which required, you know, it could be practiced anywhere. You didn't have to have a lot of equipment tied up in a bridging camp. And coupled with that, with APCs and amphibious aids, the stalwart truck was its heyday in those days. And the emphasis was getting into the water, swimming across and out the other side, getting your equipment across on the M2 or the medium girder bridge for the smaller standard gaps, which you didn't need a bridging camp for that. You could practice it all the time because the equipment was more flexible and lighter. So that was the great change. Although we never did another bridging camp as such. We used to go down to Hamlin and to Orr Park and practice these techniques, but it was using the camps in a different sort of way.
Now, this is the first time you'd had a posting in Germany to be AOR.
That's right. Mm.
How did you find the life in Germany and relations with the German population?
Generally very good. You have Nienburg was a delightful little town, say halfway.